You're listening to Pythagoras' Trousers.
Hello and welcome to the last episode of Pythagorean Astronomy for 2020 with me, Chris North. Later, we'll hear about a recent study of the structure of our own Milky Way galaxy. But given the time of the year, first let me indulge in a little reflection. This year we've covered a number of astronomical stories, some of which are still ongoing. At the start of the year there was an ongoing mystery of Betelgeuse, or Betelgeuse if you prefer, and its mysterious dimming. We now know that seems to be because of the star swelling in its old age, possibly combined with it jettisoning a cloud of cooler dust. We've seen several developments in two missions that are returning samples from asteroids. Japan's Hayabusa 2 successfully landed its samples from a near-Earth asteroid Ryugu back in Western Australia early this month, bringing back 5 grams of material. Doesn't sound like much, but not bad considering the minimum target was just 0.1 grams and quite how far the spacecraft had travelled. There's also NASA's OSIRIS-REx, which has successfully collected samples from asteroid Bennu and will drop them off in a few years' time. It was a close-run thing, as it almost grabbed too much. Then there's Chang'e 5, the Chinese mission, which has just returned a haul of samples as well, this time from the Moon. Last month we spoke to some lunar geologists about what we do with such samples. May saw the 30th anniversary of the launch of the Hubble Space Telescope, which is still very much taking observations and has had a revolutionary effect on our understanding of the universe. Astronomers eagerly await the much-delayed launch of the James Webb Space Telescope in late 2021, which will observe the cosmos at longer infrared wavelengths and, all being well, further revolutionise our understanding of the universe's history yet again. Here on Earth, we saw the sad end of another telescope, the 300-metre diameter Arecibo telescope in Puerto Rico. Last month, we reported that it was to be decommissioned following some cable failures, but in early December, a further cable failure led to the catastrophic collapse of the 900-tonne platform from a few hundred metres above the main dish. After a nearly 60-year career, including starring roles in films such as GoldenEye and Contact, there are campaigns to rebuild the dish. An expensive operation, but fingers crossed something can be done. This year also saw the launch of Solar Orbiter, which has a long looping journey towards the Sun and flew past Venus just at the end of December 2020. And of course Venus was a big story in the news as well in its own right. Back in September, an international team led by Professor Jane Greaves here in Cardiff announced the detection of a rare gas phosphine in its cloud decks. With no known chemical pathways to explain its presence, an intriguing possibility is that it's caused by microbial life. There were a lot of unknowns there about what that might even look like. Since the initial announcement, there's been much follow-up. Several other teams have queried the results, poring over the data and analysis codes released by the discovery team. That's led to a reanalysis of some of the data, and the measurement of the amount of phosphine detected has been reduced from 20 parts per billion to about 1 part per billion, but still thousands of times higher than what should be there. A reanalysis of observations from the Venus Pioneer probe back in the late 1970s found results consistent with there being phosphine, though still not conclusive. All incredibly intriguing, and has certainly caught the eye of a few people with lots of money, some of whom are planning missions to investigate further. Of course, this marks not only the end of the year, but also the end of the decade. It's remarkable to think how much things have changed in astronomy in just 10 years. 10 years ago, we had 2 missions orbiting Mars and 1 rover operating on the surface, Opportunity. Right now, we have 6 spacecraft orbiting the planet, and the rover, a different rover, Curiosity, and a lander on the surface. Early next year sees the arrival of 2 new orbiters, one from China and another from the UAE, and 2 more rovers, one of which even carries a small helicopter. We've had close-up views of a number of objects in the last decade, which have blown our minds. From comets, thanks to the Rosetta mission to Churyumov-Gerasimenko, which many of us still struggle to pronounce, of course, which has showed us levels of detail of the comet's activity and structure that we'd never imagined. To the Dawn spacecraft's view of Vesta and Ceres in the asteroid belt, showing icy deposits beneath the surface. And out to New Horizons' completely unexpected views of dwarf planet Pluto and tiny Arrokoth out in the Kuiper belt. And not forgetting, of course, the amazing views that Cassini gave us of Saturn's rings and moons, showing us just how thin they are, and Juno's stunning shots of Jupiter, showing us a swirling maelstrom of storms circling its poles. One can only imagine what treats are in store from the JUICE mission, due to launch in mid-2022 on its way to Jupiter, or the Dragonfly quadcopter mission to Saturn's moon Titan, with a planned launch towards the end of the decade. Further in towards the Sun, we've had the end of the MESSENGER mission to Mercury and the Venus Express mission to Venus. But we've still got Akatsuki of Venus and Bepicolombo on its way to Mercury, the solar system is turning into a very busy place. In terms of human spaceflight, a decade ago the space shuttle was still flying. The last space shuttle flight was in 2013, with almost all human spaceflight since then taking place from Russia. Of course, that included British astronaut Tim Peake. This year saw the first crewed missions from US soil since 2013, taking astronauts to the International Space Station thanks to SpaceX's Dragon spacecraft. It's likely that in coming years there'll be launches from other organisations, and there are plans for missions to the moon in coming years as well, though they are certainly ambitious. This decade saw the first Chinese space stations, and it's likely there will be many more Chinese missions, including perhaps missions to the moon as well. That's an awful lot of space exploration, but what about astrophysics? In the last decade, we've had measurements of the early universe on the Planck satellite, which has revealed a conflict between the measurement of the rate of expansion of the universe, as measured from its earliest moments, when compared with measurements from the local universe. Back in 2010, the planet-hunting Kepler spacecraft had only just been launched, and the number of planets known outside our solar system was measured in the hundreds. Right now, it's 10 times higher, coming in at over 4,000. There's planets around some of the nearest stars, including Proxima Centauri. The nearest decades will see more missions to not only discover but also characterise exoplanets and understand more about their atmospheres. And who knows, perhaps, just perhaps, we might find signs of life. Of course, we can't forget the detection of gravitational waves in 2015 by the LIGO experiment. Recent years have seen the addition of the Virgo and now Kagra detectors. The list of known events now runs to 50 detections, and future observing runs are going to grow that number very quickly. One of the things we've become much more used to in recent years is huge datasets, whether that's catalogues of galaxies from things like the Sloan surveys, or detections of hundreds of thousands of asteroids. Later in 2021, we'll see the first observations from the Vera C. Rubin Observatory, which will scan the entire sky, at least the bits it can see, every few nights to look for things that are moving or changing. This requires a change in the way we even think about dealing with this data. In coming years, we'll also have the first of a new class of telescope coming online, with the Extremely Large Telescope, the Giant Magellan Telescope, and the 30-metre telescope all due to be built in the next decade, and with mirrors several times the largest existing optical telescopes on Earth. As for radio astronomy, the loss of Arecibo will be compensated by the completion of the Square Kilometre Array, which will provide unprecedented views of the radio sky. But as well as huge datasets, we've got used to huge precision. A great example of that is the Gaia satellite, which for the last 7 years has been measuring the distances of hundreds of millions of stars. It's given us a clearer idea of the structure and motions of stars in the local neighbourhood, at least in astronomical terms. This brings us on to the recent study of our galaxy, I promised. It might seem surprising that we don't understand the structure of the Milky Way particularly well, but in fact it's rather hard to tell from our location. We know the basics. It's around 100,000 light-years across and contains at least a few hundred billion stars. We know it's a spiral galaxy with, we think, four spiral arms. In the middle there's a bulge and what's called a bar, a structure from the ends of which the spiral arms seem to originate. But it's really rather hard to tell exactly. Measuring the distances to things in astronomy is pretty hard, whether that's stars or clouds of gas and dust. And to boot, we're within the thin disk of our galaxy and looking at it edge-on. A recent study called SEDGISM, or the Structure Excitation Dynamics of the Intergalactic Interstellar Medium, has been studying the structure of our galaxy using the APEX telescope in Chile. But it's not been mapping the stars. It's been looking at the gas in our galaxy. This gas, mostly hydrogen, and also things like carbon monoxide and other gases and other elements, is what stars form out of. Something called the interstellar medium, the stuff between the stars. And in fact, it outweighs the mass of the stars by a factor of around 10. I spoke to Dr. Ana Duarte Cabral, a Cardiff-based member of the SEDGISM team, and I began by asking her what the galaxy looks like when you look at the gas instead of the stars.
So the atomic gas would fill in all the gaps between the stars, and beyond the central part of a galaxy where you do have the cold gas and the stars, which are formed from this cold gas, beyond that, you have a lot of gas, which is atomic and or ionized, and you wouldn't see in some galaxies. You don't even see the spiral arms anymore when you look at this component of the ISM.
So you've been looking at this cold gas. Why is the cold gas so useful for tracing what you're trying to looking at the structure of the Milky Way?
this cold gas component is in a way formed by many shocks. So you get the warm gas to compress, and by compressing it cools down, and then you form stars out of this cold and dense material. So there are several ways that it can help us, because on the one hand it helps us to look at where stars are forming. On the other hand, we can look at how actually the galaxy, by rotating, how it compresses this gas. And usually this dense and cold gas is concentrated in the spiral arms, because that's where the strongest shocks occur. And so this is also why we expect more star formation to happen in the spiral arms. And so when we look at the stellar component of a galaxy, it does follow the spiral structure as well. So it's all interlinked. So the kinematics of the galaxy produce the formation of this cold and dense gas, which then goes on to the star. So we can look at the structure of the galaxy by looking at this cold, at the cold component of the ISM.
And that kinematics, that how stuff is moving, the speed at which it's moving, is actually really crucial to doing this. Because one of the really difficult things to do in astronomy is measure how far away things are. There's various ways you could, if you have a known object, you can say if it's further away, it will appear dimmer. But actually, if you just get a blob of gas, in principle, you can't tell whether this gas is close and very small or big and far away. So how do you disentangle that when you're looking at these clumps of cold gas?
So that's actually the crucial thing about this survey that we're doing, because by having a molecular line, a spectral line, we have information about the velocity of this gas that we look at. And because we know the rotation curve of our galaxy by looking at the stars, for example, we know how things are rotating in a circular orbit around the galactic center, right? And they all move with a known velocity. Of course, there are deviations from it, from proper motions, but in a grand scale, they all move with this nice circular motion. And so when we look at a specific cloud using a molecular line, we get information about the line of sight velocity component of that cloud. So we can tell if it's moving towards us or away from us and how fast it's doing so. And by knowing where it is in our line of sight, we can then transform that into a 3D position, because we know the rotation curve of the galaxy. So this is how we do it. Obviously, it's not perfect. There are big uncertainties, especially for things nearby, because then the proper motions can be very large compared to these statistics. But for things further away, it actually works quite well. And this is why our survey is really good at looking at the overall galactic structure, because it can go further afield than what you can do, for example, with stars.
And you mentioned molecular lines and you're looking at a cold gas. What specifically are you looking at with this?
We're looking at a molecule which is, I guess you could call it a cousin of carbon monoxide. So it's what we call an isotopologue. It's 13CO, the formula. And so this is a very abundant molecule in the ISM. We can't look at molecular hydrogen, which would be great, because that is the most abundant molecule of this phase. But it doesn't emit where we need it to, in the conditions we want it to. So this particular molecule is really good, because it's very abundant, and it emits at the right sort of temperature. So in the cold and dense clouds, this is a very bright molecule, and so we can see the emission coming from this gas at these particular conditions that just before star formation happens.
And so instead of seeing the glow from stars forming, you're seeing the combined light of billions, trillions, quadrillions of these tiny molecules, all, you know, spinning around and vibrating and so on in their clouds. And that's the light you're looking at here. So what does this tell you about the galaxy? You said it's a spiral arm. It's got, we think, four spiral arms. There might be some strong ones, might be some weak ones. It seems to have this bar across the center, which is this kind of, it's not a rigid structure because it's not solid, but it seems to be this thing that rotates in the center. What does this survey that you've been involved with tell us about the structure that's new?
From what we knew before, we were expecting to see very strong spiral arms. And what this means is that we were expecting to see the gas pretty much concentrated around where the spiral arms would be, and not seem very much at all elsewhere. But when you do this exercise of taking each of these little clouds of gas, placing them in the 3D context using their velocities from their motions, the image is a lot more blurred. So we don't really see these spiral arms so well defined as we expected. It might just be that we have a lot of uncertainties that are just blurring things out. But I actually think overall, if these arms were as strong as we thought they were, we would have seen nicer trends. And so what this leads us to think is that we do have the arms, we do see them, but they're just not as nice and well defined as we expected. So maybe we are in a galaxy that is a little bit more flocculent than this grand design that we had in mind. This is also supported by the fact that we don't see very much enhanced star formation in the spiral arms, because we were expecting, again, if the arms are really strong, then this compression of gas would trigger star formation a lot more in the spiral arms. And we do have more star formation there, but it doesn't seem to be excessive. It all points into a direction where we might just be in a more flocculent type of galaxy. So still a spiral galaxy, we still have these four arms, but they're not as grand design as we thought.
Flocculent is a wonderful word. It's one of my favorite words to describe galaxies. It just means sort of fluffy, right?
Exactly. It's a fluffy galaxy. I think fluffy is it's not the word we use, but yes.
Maybe we should. So we live in this fluffy galaxy rather than this grand design, sort of nice, neat spiral arms that we might have thought previously. Does this have any implications for, you know, our understanding of the history of the galaxy, or how it might have changed or evolved, or is it not really possible to say at this stage?
There are many things that could stem from here. One of them, and I think the most important one, is that we need to sort of conciliate this type of results to what we know, for example, from the stars, because the results from Gaia, at least some of them, had suggested that the stellar potential does follow a grand design type. This is not what we see in the gas. So we will need better models to actually understand our structure a little bit better.
The stars have these neat spirals, but the gas doesn't. And is that something we've seen in other galaxies, or is that unusual?
No, as far as I know, this is, at least for me, this is a bit of a mystery. Of course, I'm not a stellar expert. Again, Gaia results are looking at things nearby to us. We are looking at things further afield. So we will need some way to sort of put these two results together and really understand what's going on in our galaxy. Now, in terms of the history of the galaxy itself, for example, if a galaxy that experiences a lot of encounters with other either dwarf galaxies or something, it triggers these type of structures in the disk. So you can have strong spiral arms being formed by the interactions with other galaxies. A galaxy that never undergoes any type of interaction will not be a grand design typically. It will be a little bit more flocculent. So either we are somewhere in the middle, and we know we have experienced some interactions in the past. We know this. Maybe they were weak, and so we have some. Maybe the stars are still following some sort of pattern, and the gas isn't, or it's just somewhere in the middle. It's not a real grand design. It's not a real flocculent. It's somewhere in the middle. I wish we could just go up and look down, but we can't. So we'll just have to keep guessing and modeling and see if we can figure it out. Yeah. We have indications that obviously we have interacted with the large and the small Magellanic clouds. We also have some of these streams of stars that we see off of the galactic plane, and these really show us that we have had interactions with smaller galaxies in the past, and they're just now sort of orbiting in the stars, the remnants of the stars of those galaxies are orbiting in weird, almost perpendicular directions to the galactic plane. So we know we have had minor encounters. As for big encounters, I don't think we've had any on the recent past, because we would still see the remnants of that. So those are, if they happened, were much early on, and that I wouldn't be able to say. I don't know.
This is a release of information about this survey you've done. Is there more to get? Is there more survey to do? What's the future got in store for CEDEGISM?
No, so CEDEGISM has finished. So we've released the data. The survey we wanted to do is what we've done. So it is a survey of nearly 90 degrees across along the galactic plane and a relatively small strip in terms of height. There are other surveys that have continued along the rest of the galactic plane, because obviously being a fixed telescope, we can't just look at the entire sky. We're limited by how much we can actually see from that specific telescope. But there are equivalent surveys of similar resolution, maybe not exactly the same tracer, but similar ones. And we're working together to sort of combine the information from all of these surveys. It's a very demanding job, because we need to be able to stitch these things together, which don't trace exactly the same thing. So we need to be really careful doing that. But the idea is to have, in the end, a full galactic plane coverage, looking at roughly the same thing at roughly the same resolution, so that we can build a clearer picture of what these spiral arms are doing. Because at the moment, we're just looking at basically a quadrant of our galaxy, so a quarter of the galaxy. And we need to stitch together with the rest of the galaxy so that we can follow these patterns a bit better. And model everything self-consistently rather than just modeling by chunks.
And when you say that the other experiments are looking at different tracers, so you're looking at this particular type of carbon monoxide, this 13CO, are they're looking at, is it different types of carbon monoxide, or is it different molecules, or?
The ones I'm mentioning, they're also carbon monoxide, so also 13CO, so the same isotopologue, but typically different transitions. And this is because of different telescopes have different facilities, look at different wavelengths, so we can't really match. But for example, one of the other surveys that is more closely related to this is one with JCMT, which is called CHIMPS, and it's also looking at 13CO, a slightly different transition, but because of the sizes of the telescope, in the end it works out that the two have comparable resolutions, so we're tracing roughly the same type of thing, and they are looking at the quadrant next to ours. So the idea is to stitch these two, and there's a few people in Cardiff as well involved in this, so we're hoping to take that forward in merging these two surveys at some point.
So then we'll have half the plane of the galaxy done, and it'll just left the other half.
The outer galaxy part. There are surveys of that done in the past. That part of the galaxy is less, how do you say, less complicated. So because basically that's the, instead of looking at the galactic center, you're looking behind us, and that's where we only have one more arm that is left. So we just see what we call the Perseus arm and maybe a little bit of the outer arm, but it's an uncomplicated part of the galaxy. So that part is easy. The complicated one is towards the galactic center, because there you see all of the arms and all of the dynamics of the bar. And this is the messy part of our galaxy that it does require a lot of more thinking about than behind us.
Well, it's fascinating to hear about the structure of the galaxy, which you might think we understand very well, but in fact are still learning an awful lot about. So Dr. Anna Duarte-Cabral, thanks very much.
Thank you.
There have been so many amazing discoveries over the last year and the last decade, and so many more to come with any luck. This year has not been what any of us expected, but let's hope that the next few years are also unexpected, but for all the right reasons. I've been doing these astronomy roundups for a decade now, and I'd like to thank everyone who's been involved. This includes Edward Gomez, who's co-presented for much of that time, but also all the guests, who've given their time and expertise freely. But for now, that's it for this month, this year, and this decade. Don't forget, you can catch up with past episodes and subscribe to the podcast at pythagastro.uk, or you can find us on Spotify by searching for Pythagorean Astronomy. You can even find the show on Twitter at astropythag. Until next month, goodbye, and a very happy new year.
You've been listening to Pythagorean Astronomy, an extended version of this month's Astronomy Roundup from Pythagoras' Trousers, a weekly science and technology radio show presented by me, Rhys Phillips. You can catch up on full episodes of Pythagoras' Trousers, subscribe to our podcast, and get in touch by going to www.pythagoras-trousers.radio.fm.